This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. A cyber attack hits the U.S., one of many countries worldwide. The data theft and ransomware attacks are being carried out by part of a cyber criminal gang, which is believed to operate inside Russia. Anne Neuberger is with the National Security Council.
They've started releasing some of the data that was stolen as part of their work to extort these companies. We strongly encourage anyone who is a user of this software to, of course, patch, lock down their systems.
Among the U.S. targets, federal agencies and major universities. A federal grand jury in Boston has indicted an Air National Guardsman for posting dozens of intelligence reports on a gaming platform. 21-year-old Jack Texera was arrested back in April for the alleged leaking of this information, which included details about the war in Ukraine. CBS's Catherine Herridge says one of the counts in the indictment matches a count in the federal indictment recently handed up to former President Trump.
It simply means the unlawful retention and transmission of national defense information. In Jack Texera's case, what's alleged in the indictment is that he released and posted this information to a social media platform, kind of a gaming platform, to brag to people, but it was some of it top secret information.
Multiple fatalities after a crash between a semi-truck and a bus taking seniors to a casino in a rural part of Canada. Assistant Commissioner Rob Hill with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Manitoba.
We've been able to establish that 15 people have been confirmed deceased as a result of this collision. 10 people were transported to hospital with various injuries.
Severe weather reported in the Texas town of Perryton. Word is a suspected tornado has damaged homes and a mobile home park. Storms have been in the forecast for a stretch from Kansas to Texas. And as CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson reports,
Oklahoma City and the metro area there that's likely to be impacted the worst by far. And then down to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex could be seeing the damaging wind gusts there too.
Federal investigators say the swimming pool deck of that beachfront condo in Surfside, Florida, that collapsed 2 years ago, killing 98 people, failed to comply with original building codes and standards. CBS's Manuel Bajorquez.
The original design fell well short of construction codes and also the construction itself. There were improper placement of steel reinforcement, those steel rods that go within the concrete. They just were not spaced correctly, according to the evidence that they have been looking at.
The union for thousands of West Coast dock workers has reached a tentative agreement on a new contract with the Pacific Maritime Association after more than a year of several work disruptions. And the number of Americans filing for jobless claims is elevated for a second straight week. This is CBS News.
Hiring is a lot easier with Indeed. Their powerful platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
Here's what you need to know in western Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Cuska. The U.S. Drought Monitor shows now that nearly half of Wisconsin is experiencing moderate drought. That's despite recent light rain. 46% of the state is in drought. It includes most of northwestern Wisconsin, as well as nearly the entire southern third of the state. That's up from 25% a week ago. Additionally, over 90% of the state is considered abnormally dry. The National Weather Service says temps will be above average and will have below normal rain for the next 6 to 10 days. In addition to all of that, there's an air quality advisory in effect as well. That's for the southern two-thirds of Wisconsin, including western Wisconsin, from the top of Polk County all the way down through Grant County on the western side of the state. That lasts through midnight. Wildfire smoke from Canada is covering most of the state, with the current air quality unhealthy for children and people with certain medical conditions. And the outdoor public pool in Chippewa Falls is set to open tomorrow. The pool, which was supposed to open last Friday, needed to delay its opening by a week due to a burst pipe. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
When it comes to achieving successful jury verdicts and settlements, one law firm stands out above the rest. Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a $6.2 million settlement for a woman permanently paralyzed as a result of medical malpractice. $4.9 million to members of a family injured due to the negligence of a truck driver and his employer. Call Gingras Thompson & Wachs today. 855-954-1186.
All in to win. Gingras Thompson & Wachs. GTWLawyers.com.
It's June Dairy Month. And though more than 5 million people call Wisconsin home, we share our state with close to 1.5 million cows. Those beautiful animals. Yes, okay, I grew up on a dairy farm outside of Green Bay. They've been here since before we became a state. Can you answer this? Most of our cows' milk currently makes which product? Is it butter, cheese, or ice cream? The answer coming up. Wisconsin's first official milk plant, 1894 in the Waupun area of Fond du Lac County. Fast forward more than 120 years, now farmer-owned with a second location in the Outagamie County village of Black Creek, the Saputo plant is even featured on History Channel's Modern Marvels for its award-winning cheesemaking. So did you guess? Most of her cow's milk, 90% of it currently makes cheese. Gouda for you. Join us in thanking our farmers by celebrating June Dairy Month. For the Civic Media Network, I'm Terry Barr.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
And who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I love this great economy project that's going on. The good folks over at the Patriotic Millionaires have put together this great economy project. And if you want to check it out, AmericanAgenda.com is the website where you get this. They're going into communities and they're doing a little education around taxation. I know, really sexy stuff, but something that should be nonpartisan. And I think we need to be focusing on a lot of issues that are nonpartisan, you know, like building roads and bridges and, you know, educating our children. Somehow, you know, in the past, we saw these as nonpartisan issues. Maybe it's a good idea that we start. The thing that I love about them is they're actually getting on the ground. They've been doing this in North Carolina for a little bit. They're in Richland Center, Wisconsin, as we speak. But they're also doing an online component. In fact, they had a meeting last night online. That folks participated in, and here to share some thoughts on this great American agenda, the great economy project. I've asked Kat Hadley to come talk with us. She's the state campaign manager for the great economy project. Again, AmericanAgenda.com, the website. Kat, thanks for taking time for us.
Always, thanks so much for having me.
So, what are we doing here? What's the goal of? Did I lay this out okay? I mean, I never like to speak for people in their organizations. So walk me through what you're doing.
Sure. So, I just became the director of the Great Economy Project, which is a cool step up. So the Great Economy Project, what we're trying to do is go into states and talk with people about economic issues and really give them the data to back up their lived experience. I think a lot of times people think that, I don't have this economic mobility because, you know, it's a personal thing that I've done. Whether it's like somebody like myself, like I was a high school dropout and worked for minimum wage jobs for a long time. And, you know, a lot of it can feel like, well, this is just what it is, you know? Later in college, I was lucky enough to have a support system where I could go back. And B, I could learn about the systems that made a lot of my life at that time what it was, you know, and asking them to say, you know, basically what we do is we try to educate them. And then we say, okay, you know about the system now, you know about our take on the economy, which is basically there needs to be a livable minimum wage, there need to be higher taxes on the rich, and we need better political equity for everyone, to just kind of wrap it up in a bow for you.
Right.
But we give them that education through a series of lectures from different professionals. And then we ask them, what do you want to do with it? And we give them the infrastructure to do that. So in Whitefield, North Carolina, where our pilot project is, they're doing an advocacy day. And what that looks like is filling a bus load of people from Whitefield, North Carolina, to go up to Raleigh and talk to lawmakers about minimum wage issues. We because we operate in kind of a different space, we don't necessarily say like, here's who you should vote for, or here's the bills you should support. But what we'll say, you know, here's what's been tried. Here's what's working well in states that are doing these things.
You're basically creating a citizen lobbying brigade. You're basically engaging with citizens to go and do what citizens are supposed to do.
Yeah, well, and to challenge them, you know, because I think a lot of times, and I'm sure you see this, where I run into people all the time and they'll say, well, you know, we can't do anything to change this. No one's going to listen to them. And what I try to challenge is, well, that can feel very true. Do you think that maybe that system is there for a reason? Do you think that maybe sometimes when we feel disenfranchised in that, that system is easier to manipulate and to really make the system what it is today? Yeah. So, you know, a lot of it is challenging the idea that we're all powerless and that there's nothing that we can do about anything.
Yeah. The other thing that I see a lot, my conservative friends love to throw this out at me, go, well, you know, people just need to work hard. You know, there's opportunity out there. You know, pull your bootstraps, pull yourself up, go work hard. And the reality is I don't know if you've ever worked in a fast food restaurant. That's hard work. That's a lot of hard work. That's more hard work than I want to do, especially for the poor wages that they get paid. This idea that hard work is the solution. Look, everybody should work hard. Absolutely 100% on board with that. But that's not the panacea. That's not the only answer here.
Well, and, you know, yeah, I always tell people, you know, when we're in these meetings, you know, when I worked as a waitress, those shifts, I would come home and collapse, you know, and that's the other thing, too, is on the other side of this is I run into legislators that say things like, well, they're not coming to me to talk about this issue, so it must not be an issue. And it's like, these are your hardest working constituents that don't have the time to do this. They don't have the physical ability to do this. And sometimes they don't even have the car. When I worked for minimum wage, I didn't have a car. I couldn't drive to Lansing. That's where I'm from, Michigan. I couldn't drive to Lansing and tell them, hey, you need to negotiate this wage floor for me. And so, yeah, I think the idea that we live in a system where you can maybe work your way up or do these things, it could have been true in the 80s, but it's just not, it's not even true anymore. And we know, like, you know, there's that amazing chart from the Economic Policy Institute that shows that in the 70s or so, compensation just branched from productivity. You know, it just, they're not tied together, and they haven't been for years, and that gap keeps growing and growing and growing. So,
but
you know,
what I do there, Kat, and if I could throw this in there, especially for your great economy project, there's also another great graph that they had that shows union density and labor union participation, how it does the exact same thing, how from the end of World War II up into the right about the middle 70s, productivity went up, wages kept pace right with it. And as union density deadlined, so did the ability of workers to get better wages, hours, and conditions. So I think there's something there potentially, maybe something we could throw in there a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, our program is always growing and changing. You know, we have the online cohort right now, and people are throwing out different ideas, and we do try to take feedback from participants and see if we can bring in experts, you know, because we want to give people information they can use, and have that grow over time. And with the other part of this, you know, with the activist side of this, we also, you know, we do this thing called American Deciders. So after you go through the education, you can join the American Deciders. And that's not necessarily just community action events, but we're also trying to have them plan monthly dinners where we have experts go in and talk about whatever they want to learn about, you know, because there's so much that goes on, you know, like when we talk about any current events, you know, with the economy, where you kind of need this background, but it's hard to access for people. Maybe it's behind a paywall, or maybe it's just not explained in the terms that we can actually use in day to day, you know, and so we want to make sure that we can kind of continue to educate as we go.
No, what I love about what you guys are doing, and I've said this before, is it's the actual face-to-face, on-the-ground, grassroots organizing. Look, there's a lot of online tools, and yes, you're doing the online thing, and that's great, but there's still nothing better than being in a room full of a bunch of people with a bunch of thoughts and having dinner and throwing ideas across the table. Maybe they get heated, maybe it doesn't, but at the end of the day, you walk away going, hey, we all, no matter where we're at on this issue, we all want to move the country forward. And we walk away with that in mind, and not, I hate that red hat or that blue hat or whatever. I think what you're doing is really important.
Thank you so much. Well, and I think what we saw in our pilot and what really blows people away. You know, we actually had a piece just on NPR Morning Edition this week that came out, and we had some of our cohort members in that piece, which was excellent to like hear their voices in this and have them talk about what it meant. But we had people from all different walks of life. You know, we in our intro, we say that this is for Democrats, Republicans, independents, and hate them all. So, you know, this is for everyone. But the thing that we know, and we knew before going to this, is that Democrats and Republicans agree on these issues. The thing is, can we make this their issue? Can we explain it to them and make it something they can work together on? And for Whiteville, the answer was yes. Right. We can absolutely do this. And I think that's a great first step.
Can I amend that real quick?
Mm-hmm.
Democratic and Republican voters, I think, because you know, when you talk to people face-to-face, individually, I agree with you. They're on the same taxation. They're on the same part. Raise the minimum wage on the same page. A lot of this stuff, we're all working people are on the same page. But when you put on the red hat or the blue hat, go to the voting booth and vote for those people who go to D.C. or to Harrisburg where I live or to any state capital, that kind there's a disconnect because yeah. The voting of the party person is much different generally than the wish of the mass. At least that's my thought. Do you see that?
You know, surprisingly, not in my cohort. You know, that we even have there's a really great clip of Brittany and this guy Kevin, and they're she's a Democrat, he's a Republican, but you know, they're both talking about, you know, if I had somebody run on this issue, knowing what I know now, I'd have to figure out what to do with that. You know,
you're making my point for me. The point is, the individual voter, they agree. The Republican and the Democrat raise the minimum wage, but yet the Republican Party is hell-bent on never raising the minimum wage. Take pledges against it. And yet these voters are still voting for those people who do these things.
Well, and I think one hope is that, you know, because we really focus on making this a space for everyone. And one hope is that, you know, people start demanding that accountability within their party on both sides.
That's it.
Because this is the both sides issue. And what, you know, we can get into that. But
no, the reason I bring this up is I say all the time, Republicans, take your party back to the sane line.
Yes.
Because there was a time when there were pro-labor Republicans. There was a time when there were pro-minimum wage Republicans. There was a time when, name the issue, where we were somewhere between the curbs. We weren't on the sidewalks throwing you know, platitudes at each other. We weren't yelling at each other from the sidewalks. We were in the streets getting stuff done. That's where I'd like to see us get back to.
Yeah, same. Agreed. And, you know, I have my family's from Wahpeton, North Dakota, which their little sweater or the gift shop is like, you know, middle of nowhere, 5 miles, Wahpeton 10. So it's a small town and they're all deeply conservative folks, but you know, I've seen with them even the shift, you know, in talking about this program with them, they're like, yeah, I totally agree with this, you know, and they're nurses and oil workers and union folks, really. And so I think that there's an opportunity if we can cut through the noise and focus and really talk about what this could mean and the tangible difference this would make for people, that's worth fighting for.
Right there.
And
with
also, you know, I focus on a lot of just, this is our country, and we have to take the time to mend these bridges and to do this work. But it's always worth taking, and so it's really good to see a really positive response within our cohort of people that agree with that and are doing that.
No, good stuff. Now, your next online meet and greet is going to be on June 21st. AmericanAgenda.com is where you go to sign up for this, right?
Yep. American Agenda Online. And we'll have Chuck Collins talking about he's an amazing researcher from the Institute of Policy Studies. And he's going to talk about the cost of billionaire philanthropy. So where those dollars really end up and how that system has corrupted itself. So it'll be a really interesting meeting. We have our recordings also online so people that are interested can watch them. And we will have a few more meetings coming after that. We'll be in Richland Center starting on July 12th. And it'll be a really fun time. We'll have another meet and greet. We'll be in Pennsylvania soon as well. And we're looking to expand further, but that's where we have commitments now.
Looking forward to it. And for our listeners in Richland Center, Wisconsin, that's going to be at the Phoenix Center at 100 South Orange Street there in Richland Center on July 12th. You know, we'll make sure we get some links out on how folks can take a look at this. But this sounds like great stuff. I'm hoping people will gravitate to this, if nothing for nothing else but for curiosity, and maybe they learn something along the way. AmericanAgenda.com, the website. Cat Hadley, I appreciate you taking some time for us. I look forward to hearing more about what you're finding out and the successes you're having. Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you so much, and I'll see you at Netroots.
Yeah, all right. Good stuff. Kat Hadley, remember, check out the website there at AmericanAgenda.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I like Kat Hadley a lot, and I like the work that they're doing at the Great Economy Project. Let's quick go to the phones. I got a caller on line one. What's your name? What's on your mind? Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rick.
Hey, Alice. Guess who?
What I wanted to say was, I wanted to comment on a couple of things. Number one, you were talking about the Social Security at the beginning of the program, and I can tell you, having just gone through that, my retirement, full retirement age is 67. So, of course, when I filed for my Social Security back in last year, I have to take a reduced rate.
Right.
And even though I was already getting it, then when my husband died, to get survivor benefits, it took 2 months. So we definitely need to update the system. We need more people. And the Republicans need to back off and leave things alone. And the second thing I wanted to say is, really, you think it was all Bill Clinton? Oh, come on, Rick.
God,
now, we all know that Hillary, Hillary is the one that's the deadly deadly woman. I mean, come on. But you have a good evening, Rick.
Okay. I thought she was going to attack me for that. I'm going, it's a joke. But hey, you know what? Maybe that's their couple-y thing, going doing wet work together. Maybe. Thanks, Alice. I appreciate it. But here's the thing. You know, I go back to what Kat was talking about. This idea that, and I've had these conversations with people for years, where you agree on economic issue after economic issue. We should raise taxes on wealthy people. We should have a tax code that, you know, the bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry, you know, because we need the investments, that, you know, public education should be funded, that, you know, divide and conquer is bad. We can go through the issue. And I've got Republican friends who agree. You know, they want good schools, safe neighborhoods, you know, good jobs, good wages, health care, pensions, all that stuff. They want what was the American dream. And yet they continually vote for people who are attempting to destroy all of that. And this is one of those things that's just mind-blowing to me. And look, I ran through this with Democrats back in the 90s and 2000s as well. Look, there are neoliberal Democrats I would not vote for. These free traders, who the union busters, they, to me, that stuff doesn't, the red hat, blue hat doesn't matter. It comes back to the issues. And this is why I like what the patriotic millionaires are doing in this. They're talking about, this is the issue. How do we get this issue moved? And maybe this is the way forward. How do we get the issue moved? I don't know. Let's quick go to the phones. What's your name and what's on your mind?
Hey, what's up, Rick? It's Granny again.
What's up, buddy?
Not much, man. I heard you saying some of the talking points, and at this point,
which talking points?
American
which ones?
Well, I was getting there. Politics. Can you really have a stance? Like, if you have a stance, you're basically choosing a side. You're almost like trying to get to a civil war at that point, right? Like, shouldn't you be in the middle and just go, listen, I know we're voting for the devil at some point.
If you have a stance, you have to pick a side. But there's this thing called compromise that I throw in there as well.
Well, hold on.
I mean,
you said we have to pick a side. You don't.
Okay. Walk me through your thought on this.
Well, I mean, we don't have to pick a side. I mean, you know, they on January 6th, if it was a real insurrection, they could have just locked the doors and lit the whole building on fire, right? And we could have started over a little bit. And that's what the Constitution was written for.
Was it?
Yes,
the Constitution
was
written
it
so
was
that we could burn down our own capital?
Absolutely. The Canadians did it. Why can't we?
Yeah, I'm not going there with you. I'm not on board with that. So I'm going to pick a side to not be on yours on that one. But do you have another issue?
Okay. No. Okay. I'm just asking. What side would you pick? Are you going with Donald Trump on this one?
No, I'm not a Trump supporter at all. I never have been because of a thousand reasons. Are there things that he's done that I like? There are a couple of things I could say that he did that were not bad. But for the most part, I don't think he's a good leader. I don't think he's good for the country. We could go on for probably the next half hour. Would I love to see someone else? Yeah, I absolutely would. Do I think Biden's done a good job? Absolutely. I think the policies he's brought have been very good for the country and moving us in the right direction.
You really think
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. I think, the infrastructure bill is going to help rebuild our country. I think building factories to bring chips production back, reshoring manufacturing is a huge step in the right direction. Breaking some of the neoliberal stuff that's been going on for the last 40 years around open border free trade. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of stuff that we've got to do, and we've got to do in a very short order that have been neglected for decades. So, yeah, I think Biden's done a good job.
Okay, and then what about the bribery?
So evidently, we just talked about this. Evidently, the key witness just died, or someone killed them suspiciously. Or here's my problem with all of these conspiracy theories. There's a lot of people, and I said this from the very beginning when this came out. When you can show me a direct line from Hunter Biden and Burisma to Joe Biden's door, then I'm going to be with you. But all we keep hearing from the Giulianis of the world are these wild, fantastical claims that they say on the F channel and on talk radio and on Newsmax, but they never, never go into a courtroom and put their hand on a Bible and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help them God. And yet I've got a 47-page indictment that is saying this is what Trump did. This is what we're putting our hand on the Bible for. So here's where I am at. When you go in front of a judge and you swear under oath with the fear of perjury that something is true, I will then believe you. But if repeatedly you keep throwing out all of these fantastical claims that you then never bring in front of a judge, I stop believing you. And the 2020 election is a perfect example of that. Does that make sense?
I can see where you're coming from. I mean, I'm not going to wholeheartedly agree with you there, and because again, and I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat, dude. Like, again, I'm more let's burn it to the ground and restart.
All right, anarchy. We love anarchy.
Yeah, I would consider myself an anarcho-capitalist,
okay,
if you will. You know what I mean?
And in that system, who's the winner in that system? Would it be Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, or do you think you do better in that system?
Oh no, those guys probably wouldn't be around too much.
They would own everything.
I would say no. Absolutely, they would not.
How would they not own everything?
Have you ever heard of guns?
Oh, okay. So you're going to go steal it from him. Okay. No, I'm okay.
I wanted to hear you say that. It would be taken, and I'm not saying that they would have to, you know, pay that sacrifice or whatever, but I am saying that, and again, you wouldn't have to, ideal.
I got 15 seconds.
An anarcho-capitalist.
Okay. I appreciate the call. I got to take a break here, but I love the idea. We can't tax them, but we'll just get our guns and steal it. Thanks so much for the call. I love it. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1908. That was the day that the Executive Board of the American Federation of Labor established its Metal Trades Department. The goal was to coordinate the organizing and legislative efforts of those in the many metal trades. The department joined together workers from sheet metal workers to blacksmiths, iron shipbuilders to brass and silver workers, foundry workers to stove mounters, and more. In all, 600,000 workers were members. The new department held its first convention in Cincinnati, Ohio, that following February. One of the earliest major work projects involving the new department was the construction of the Panama Canal. More than 70,000 workers, including many metal workers, worked on the canal over a decade. By the time the canal was completed in 1914, more than 5,000 workers had died on the project. The metals department often had to navigate an ever-changing demand for the skills of its members. In times of war, as orders for battleships soared, the workers were in high demand. During peacetime, orders fell. In 1945, the U.S. Navy recognized the contribution of metal workers during World War II. They christened the USS Joseph S. McDonough. The ship was named after a former secretary treasurer of the Metal Trades Department who had worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. One of the key victories of the Metal Department was the passage of the 1938 Federal Apprenticeship and Training Act. The year prior, Metal Department President John Fry was appointed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt as the labor representative for the first apprenticeship committee. The act formalized apprenticeship training programs. Today, the Metals Department of the AFL-CIO represents thousands of workers in 17 unions.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Why would your local newspaper not even mention an important local news story? Perhaps because it's a damning story about the conglomerate owner of the paper. This month, hundreds of journalists working for major dailies in some two dozen cities across America joined in an extraordinary mass walkout from their jobs. They were protesting the rank greed, gross mismanagement, and abandonment of democratic duty by the owner of their papers. That owner is Gannett, a massive financial conglomerate that has grabbed control of more than 200 dailies in 43 states. This is a huge, multidimensional news story about news itself. But where was the coverage? Big story number one. Unbeknownst to most people in these communities, they no longer have a local daily paper. Control over everything from news content to price now belongs to bean-counting strangers at Gannett headquarters hundreds of miles away. Big story number two. More fundamentally, control has moved from journalists to bankers. Gannett is owned by SoftBank, a Japanese hedge fund that has rapaciously looted American newsrooms to grab extravagant fees, salaries, and profits for its rich financial hucksters. Big story number three. The workaday hometown reporters, photographers, and others who actually produced Gannett's papers are making a gutsy stand against the profiteer, not just for themselves, but for the essential ideals of journalistic integrity and grassroots democracy. Biggest story of all, Gannett's 200 papers cravenly joined in a concerted blanket cover-up of this story, stiffing the public they're supposed to serve and disrespecting the ethical stand of their own employees. Even Gannett's flagship paper, USA Today, which regularly reports on other labor actions, took a dive on covering the journalistic malfeasance of its own overseer. This is Jim Hightower saying, to fight hedge fund corporatization of journalism, go to newsguild.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the folks over at the Center for American Progress are launching what we talked about at the beginning. Look at what the Biden administration is doing. Look at what that infrastructure bill is doing in your community. Now, I would have liked it to be a lot more, you know, flashy, like a big giant Joe Biden with his finger pointing going, I did that. And then inside of it, you find all the little things, like I said earlier. But, you know, you got to get the information out there. And as I said, you know, I think what Josh Shapiro is doing here in Pennsylvania, putting a camera on that bridge being rebuilt, really important stuff. But here to share some thoughts on, well, where we are, where we're going, and how the economy's doing, I've asked our good friend Christian Weller to come talk with us. Christian is a senior fellow there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. He's also a professor of public policy at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Christian, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Rick.
So I got to give you guys credit over at the Center for American Progress. I've been saying, compile this information, make sure it's available. If not for just for people like me to go, hey, this is all this information right at our fingertips. The number of jobs, the investments, communities, you know, all that stuff I think is really fabulous.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, you can go to the website, and I think it's 25,000 different web job sites that people can search in their local communities. And I think it's very important to I'm an economist, and I look at sort of the big numbers and saying it's $1 trillion we're spending on infrastructure. That's meaningless. It's a big number. We're spending lots of money. But I think what matters to people is, like, are they fixing the potholes? Or is it a rickety bridge that I'm commuting over going to be fixed? Is the rail line that I'm using no longer going to catch on fire? So that's the stuff that matters. And I think putting that information out there and localizing it is critical. Whether we need the flashy, like, Joe Biden sign that says, I did this. I think we're in the nonpartisan think tank, so we couldn't really do that. But right. our goal here is put the information out there, localize that, show what government actually does. When it spends money, it does good things in your community. It makes life easier, safer. We no longer have bridge collapsing. We no longer have train tracks catching on fire, which seems to be a daily occurrence in the greater Boston area where I live. So that's sort of the stuff that matters to people.
No, and this is where the good government stuff happens. I mean, I've got friends, and I know you're purely nonpartisan, but I look at my friends on the Republican side of the aisle, and it's all government can't do anything, shouldn't do anything, we won't let them do anything. And then when things go wrong, they go, why didn't government do anything? I mean, it just seems it seems twisted.
Well, that's the shame, right? Like, infrastructure was always sort of the bipartisan common ground that everybody agreed that this is what government can do and should do because it is the only entity that can take the long risk. There is no private company that steps up and says, I'm going to fix the bridge in Philadelphia. Or Philadelphia is even sort of, you could imagine possibly a private company coming in, but in rural Pennsylvania and rural Massachusetts, there aren't private companies coming in because the economics don't make sense. But this is where people live. In government is the only entity that can undertake those things and invest for the longer term to make sure that we have safe roads and bridges and canals and rail.
And for me, it's the jobs that come out of this. I mean, you know, one of the things about this tracker that you guys are doing is pointing out the employment that's coming out of this and the job numbers and the reverberation effect through the local economies. And, you know, the good stuff that comes out of infrastructure spending is, yeah, we get this new bridge and we get this new road. But the good stuff, too, is we get to support communities with local building trades and people put food on the table for the kids and roof over their heads and all of that stuff. That, to me, is just as important.
Well, there's two factors here, right? We only measure typically the jobs that are created when we build the bridges and when we repair the roads, the construction jobs, the manufacturing jobs that come directly out of it. But what it also means is that people get to stay in their communities, that it is easier for businesses to do business in local communities and hire people there. They don't have to relocate to the big cities where there is better infrastructure. And I think we often overlook sort of these follow-on effects that these maintaining infrastructure. And it goes really like from the roads to bridges now with the massive investments in broadband across the country. It will allow people and businesses to stay where they are and where they want to be, because that's where their friends and their families are. That's where their communities are. And that will create job stability for the long term. And we sort of forget that this is sort of very long term follow on effect from these investments.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's another reason that I'm a big supporter of prevailing wage, to make sure that those jobs are kept local and that you don't have transients coming through doing shoddy work. It's just one of those things. But the reason I had you come on, and you know, we see the inflation numbers. All we hear about is inflation. I saw the Fed the other day is holding on interest rates. There was some talk maybe they're going to raise it, but they said they may still down the road. We're going to expect more. Where do you think we are right now? I mean, inflation seems to be on everyone's mind. We're Fed, you know, this is the worst ever, and it's all Joe Biden's fault. Where are we at this moment, and are we doing the right things, I guess, through federal policy and through the Federal Reserve?
Well, let's see where we are. We have come down from an annual rate of inflation of 9.1% last year to about 4%. 4% is still high, but most of that, or a huge chunk of that, is concentrated in the housing market. And all indications are that we will see continued decline in inflation in the housing market and moderation there. That doesn't mean housing prices or rents are going to come down, but they're going to moderate to normal levels from all we see. Like the reason why we do this is, why we think this as economists, is when you look at the indexes that Zillow points out for new leases, they have the new leases, the increases in new leases have been declining very sharply, more sharply than average rents. And so the new leases tend to lead what's happening to average rents. And so we generally expect inflation to continue coming down, especially as the housing market settles down to more normal levels post-pandemic. And in that world, the question is, has the Federal Reserve done enough? Has it done too much? I'm sort of, and here I really can speak only for myself, I think the Federal Reserve really needs to tread very carefully and possibly hold for longer than just 1 month, as it said. Because one thing is, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates now by 5 percentage points from 0 to 5% since last March. But it takes 6 to 12 months before you feel the effects of this. So a lot of what the Fed has done hasn't made its way through the economy. And we expect the economy to continue slowing down. How much is a different question. I think at this point, we have enough room on the inflation side for the Federal Reserve to say, like, let's wait and see. There is enough risks in the economy from higher interest rates, some of the banking failures and banking troubles that we have, that the Federal Reserve is at risk of overdoing it. Right. And so I would argue that, and many other economists are too, that now is a time to pause, not just for 1 month, but for multiple months, and see what's happening.
Clearly, you're the expert here. I mean, I look at it and I go, just from a layman's view, I think too aggressive, too fast, too much, too soon kind of thing. And as you said, we still don't know what they've done yet. So I'm concerned of us going the other way, of things getting, you know, things.
Right. And it's like, when it comes to Federal Reserve policy, it's an asymmetric thing, right? Like, the economy sort of, like, they can be really good at slowing the economy, but cutting interest rates doesn't have the same effect on the other side. So if the economy tanks, we then have to go to Congress and say, please spend more money. And this Congress is not going to spend more money. With that in mind, with the political risks in mind, I think the Federal Reserve definitely has to go very slowly. Now, one thing that has surprised, I think, a lot of us as economists is how strong the economy actually is, like, at least in the labor market numbers. And that's sort of another point. The economy is really strong. We continue to add around 250,000 jobs every month, even in a world of higher interest rates, even in a world of massive political uncertainty where the Republicans in Congress are holding the federal government's ability to pay its bills hostage to their political whims. Even in that environment, surprisingly, the economy has done very well and inflation has come down. Imagine what we could do if the Federal Reserve sort of took off the foot off the brakes a little bit. Economic growth would be a little stronger. We would add more jobs, like in terms of helping, especially building a strong, resilient middle class. I think we would be in a completely different world.
Let me ask you this, as an economist, because I hear my Republican friends all the time saying, we need to cut spending. We're spending too much. We've got a spending problem, Christian. You know it. We got a spending problem. All these infrastructure investments, spending problem, all the investments we're going to make in taking on climate change. Can't have that. It's bad. It's wasteful spending. What happens if we pull all that spending back? I mean, because I have some friends who think, federal government should stop spending entirely. What happens to the economy if that happens?
The economy would tank. But the main thing is, like, most of the new spending was paid for either through tax increases or by clawing back some of the pandemic spending that wasn't spent. But the other part is, like, let's talk about climate risks, for instance. Greening our economy, making our cities and roads and our economy more resilient to climate change. I mean, I live in the greater Boston area, right? We want to protect Boston, and I live close to the water. We want to protect our cities and towns from rising floodwaters. If we don't do that, we're going to be left with enormous costs when the floodwaters come, when the hurricanes hit the East Coast. And increasingly, they're hitting the Northeast. They don't stay in the Southeast. So it's very short-sighted to say, like, we shouldn't be investing in that. It is an upfront investment into our immediate future, into the future of our kids. If we green our economy and we make our economy more resilient to climate change, those are necessary investments, and they will save us tons of money down the road.
No, and it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, even my kids, when they were smaller, like, Dad, how come every building doesn't have solar panels on it? How come our house does, but none of the other neighbors do? And I'm going, because we just haven't prioritized it in this country. I mean, we need to have that kind of, that Manhattan Project kind of thinking if we're going to solve climate problems down the road, or even if we just want to create, cheap, reliable energy.
Right, and I think... it's not just the Investment Act, but also the Inflation Reduction Act that sort of has this open-ended promise of providing tons of tax credits for people who want to install solar credits, who want to buy an electrical vehicle, and helping us green the economy. And generally, I think most economists think that a lot of the spending is actually transformational. It happens through a tax code, but it's going to have a massive impact. And the other part is also what the pandemic taught us: we have to be more independent from suppliers elsewhere. So a lot of manufacturing is coming back, and we now see a manufacturing construction boom that we hadn't seen in decades. So there is lots of stuff, good stuff happening, and it's backed by government spending, by these promises towards greening the economy, making the economy more resilient.
No, it's all good stuff in my view. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Christian Weller. He's a senior fellow over at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. He's also a professor of public policy at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. On this front, on the whole greening of the economy, the new jobs, I saw a thing the other day that said solar production is going to, increase from, like 500,000 new jobs, like 4 million new jobs in the next, 5 or 6 years. I mean, the numbers, the projections are enormous. And
we're starting from such a low base, right? And so part of it, like the growth rate is going to be top, but it has to work on all sides. You have to make sure from a government side that there is sort of the demand is there, that we're going to support it, we're going to have the infrastructure for it there. But at the local level, you got to make sure that you train people in the trade schools and the vocational schools to install solar panels, which is often a shortfall in our educational system, that we don't pay attention to. We don't think holistically about what needs to happen, what will happen. These things are necessary. I think there is that this needs to work at all levels of government. And part of our very decentralized federal system, part of the problem is that it's often not coordinated. But I think increasingly everybody is getting on board that you look at solar panels, wind power, all of that, and it happens in red states and blue states everywhere, that these investments are happening and are necessary, and they're very profitable very desirable.
Which brings us back to kind of where we started, in that, you know, your organization is putting forth a tracker of all the projects that are going on through the infrastructure bill. Is there something like this on the solar array front, on the, hey, we're building energy in a new renewable way, and hey, you can take a see, I think what Shapiro's doing here in Pennsylvania with the cameras, and you can actually see it happening, I think is incredible. Anything like that you see on the horizon or being done?
You mean in terms of the investments?
Building the solar panels, all of that.
Yeah, the Obama administration tried to do that with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and had actually very good ideas, and sort of like the financial industry. I once talked to some very conservative financiers in Georgia, and they thought this was like, they hated Obama, but they thought that was sort of really good stuff. Unfortunately, the Tea Party got wind of it and sort of killed the whole investments and support for solar. Now, a lot of this stuff is happening anyway. You look, like, I was just in Arizona a few months ago, and there is wind panels, there is windmills and solar panels all over southern Arizona, and
it as there should be.
As there should be. There's lots of land, lots of sun, it helps, it makes sense.
It's a freaking desert.
The part of it is also the combination between wind and sun is very predictable and generates predictable revenue. So it's like a very nice little savings account for the investors, right? So you get a guaranteed 5% rate of return because you know this stuff always happens. The sun always shines and the wind always blows. So I think it made sense on all fronts, from the investment perspective, from the building, from the construction, from the greening the economy perspective. The government can do a lot to accelerate it, and that's sort of where the Biden administration has put it, mark it down with the Inflation Reduction Act, helping households get in on it, more solar panels, heat pumps, and electrical vehicles are sort of the big ones in the Inflation Reduction Act. Yeah. Again, that comes through the tax code, and they're very progressive, so the lower income you are, the more benefits you get from the federal government for investing in your own future.
Yeah, it's still amazing. You know, there was a story not too long ago of, you know, if it gets really hot in Tempe or in Phoenix, and people have to use their air conditioning and we have a brownout, X amount of people are going to go to the emergency room. I'm going, yeah, this is probably why you should increase energy production, help your grid by, I don't know, putting a roof over your state and collecting all that sunlight and maybe turning it into energy that would help that air conditioning.
It's collecting energy, but then there is the grid structure. That's sort of where I think the federal government can invest more money. Yeah. And that's where the infrastructure investment comes in.
There is a lot of things we can do other than throw up our hands and go, I don't know what we're going to do.
Well, we are doing that. I mean, that's the point, right? This is the point of our conversation. We are within the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. We are actually doing a lot of stuff. And you see it in the numbers, and you see it around the country, and you will see more of this over the coming years. Of all the good stuff that's
happening. It's just not fast enough in our McDonald's. We need everything in a neat little bag out the window as we're driving past kind of society. But I'm glad that you've come and shared some of it with us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues.
Anytime.
And it will. But Christian, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Anytime. Thank you for having me, Eric.
Good stuff. Christian Weller, senior fellow there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do and also their tracker. I'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. About 400 janitors were protesting at Century City, a large office complex in Los Angeles. It was part of SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign in LA. The janitors had gone out on strike against International Service Systems. The strike had started on May 30th, and despite promises that they would not interfere with the protest, the LAPD showed up wielding batons. They demanded the janitors immediately vacate the premises. But instead of dispersing, the protesters linked arms, and in a show of solidarity, they marched toward the 150 police dressed in riot gear.
Police responded by savagely beating protesters, clubbing people on the ground as they tried to stand back up. One demonstrator, who was 3 months pregnant, suffered a miscarriage caused by the police beating. The media recorded the brutal attack. Coverage spurred outrage at the actions of the police that day. It also made the janitors more determined than ever to win a contract. Public pressure resulted in a new contract with a $2 an hour raise for the janitors. They also won family health care coverage. SEIU filed suit over the police conduct. And 3 years later, the LA City Council awarded the union more than $2.3 million. But the police did not have to admit guilt for the attack. 200 janitors gathered on the steps of City Hall to await the settlement decision. Joel Vasquez, one of the janitors who was beaten on that day, addressed the crowd saying, "The people who are supposed to protect us didn't. They beat us." Today has become a day of commemoration of the janitors' struggle. In 2001, janitors gathered in LA to remember that past victory and rally for economic justice. One marcher carried a sign that read, "What's dignity? New shoes for my daughter, a birthday party for my son." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So, evidently on June 24th in North Carolina, there's going to be a big speech by Kamala Harris to mark the anniversary of the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade. This is, you got to get Kamala out there and more visible as the election comes near. Got to make her look a little bit more presidential. And look, it's campaign season. So this Saturday, the president's going to be in Philadelphia accepting the AFL-CIO's endorsement. Philadelphia, interesting time to be going to Philly when the bridges collapse. And I've had a couple of people go, "How do you think he's going to get here?" I'm going, "Well, I got to think helicopter," because I don't think they're going to be a... Trust me when I say this. If they come in with a giant motorcade that has to go over I-95 or anywhere near where that bridge is collapsed... the people of Philadelphia will remember. So don't do it. Do not do it. Now, here's the other thing. You know, we're in the middle of June. That means Supreme Court, there's a lot of cases that are, we'll see. I guess that's the best way to put it. There are a lot of cases that we'll see. I've been holding my breath because there are still 21 cases yet to trickle down to the rest of us. There are 4 big ones. There's the affirmative action and the student loan one. Those are going to affect people in a big way. There's the LGBT rights one and the freedom of speech one that's going on. And there's also the state legislative theory one, the one from North Carolina, the big voting case. It's going to be interesting to see where this takes us, what these Supreme Court justices have made some interesting decisions. And, you know, as you've heard me say before, my fear is they take us back to a time that most of us can't fathom. And as a working person, I look at the working class cases that I know are in the pipeline, ready to be decided in the years to come, and it's going to take us back to days where, we had a guy a little bit ago say he's an anarcho-capitalist, and that idea of anarchy and capitalism, that the capitalist system is that's what's going to thrive, that's where they're taking us to. Where the Bezoses of the world, where the wealth class of the world, where if they don't want to give it, not a big deal. I say they're taking us back to the days of the Lochner era, where if you were hungry enough and desperate enough to work in poverty wages for desperation wages, that's your choice. It's your liberty. That whole idea of liberty of contract that we lived under for about 40 years. The idea that back then, you couldn't pass any law to pass minimum wage or maximum hour laws or any infringement on the employer-employee relationship, which in my state of Pennsylvania, in their workers' comp law, still refers to the master-servant relationship being the employer and the employee.
So there's a lot of concern, in my view, of what our Supreme Court is going to do to us. That's why elections have consequences. But I want to hear your thoughts. Missed any of today's program? Something I said got on your nerves, under your skin? Want to weigh in? Rick at therickSmithShow.com. That's where you send those emails. Hate goes to the top. I got to answer that first. Even if it is, two words. make sure you grab the podcast. Where